what weapons did Iran use to strike Israel last night? Iran has an arsenal of ballistic missiles, cruise missiles and drones, which have been used in the recent past to target Israel. It's believed that nearly 200 ballistic missiles were fired by Iran. Let's focus on that for a moment. Now, Iran operates, for starters, a 300-kilometer range missile called the Shadab-1. Now, that's a relatively short-range missile. It cannot hit Israel. It can only strike targets in this region, well away from Israel, which is over here. Now, another missile is the Fateh missile that flies between 300 and 500 kilometers. Again, that missile doesn't have the range to hit Israel. Another missile is the Shadab-2. It's got longer legs, 500 kilometers, still out of range of targets in Israel. We've got an image of that missile up on the screen as well. As you can see, every missile I'm describing, we've got an actual image of. The Zulfaqar missile can just about touch Israel. It's got a range of 700 kilometers. So parts of Israel just about can be targeted by this missile. There is a missile called the Qiyam-1, which has a range of 50 kilometers more, 750 kilometers. That's what it looks like. It's relatively more advanced, can strike a few more targets in Israel, but not deep inside Israel. But there is the Shahab-3 with a range of 2,000 kilometers, which can quite easily strike all of Israel. In fact, it can strike many other areas in the region. So that's a missile, variants of which may actually have been used. But Israel, for its part, has the world's most sophisticated ballistic missile defense system. It's a tiered defense system. It's a system that was clearly breached last night. Now, we saw video of Iranian missiles hit Tel Aviv. These were some of the launches which actually took place of those ballistic missiles from Iran and making contact with targets in parts of Tel Aviv. Now, Israel does have that ballistic missile defense system. What we don't know is how many of these missiles hit their targets and whether some of the impacts were of fragments of the missiles coming down after they were intercepted by the Israeli missile shield. While we do talk about surface-to-air missiles being fired by Israel in defense, we really do need to take a look at the distance that these surface-to-air missile interceptors travel and the altitude or height to which they can fly to take out threats like the ones that you're seeing on your screen, which are the Iranian ballistic missiles which were fired. So for starters, let's talk a little bit about Israel's Arrow system. Now that's the missile. It's part of a system, so we use the word missile and system interchangeably. Now when one talks about surface-to-air missile systems, you have to talk about the range of the missile and you also have to talk about the altitude to which it flies. So the Arrow system can intercept incoming ballistic missiles in the exo-atmosphere as well, or just outside the atmosphere. It has a range of 2,000 kilometers, 2,400 kilometers, in fact, and it can fly to an altitude of a whopping 100 kilometers. It's perhaps the most advanced system of its class in the world. So that's part one. It was used yesterday, but there were other systems, presumably, which were also used to make a large number of the interceptions. So let's look at the next one, which is the David Sling. Now, that's the missile. The missile, it's called the Nammer. It's part of the David Sling system. That can fly to a range of 300 kilometers and an altitude of about 15-odd kilometers in making interceptions. And finally, what we all talk about is the Iron Dome. Now, that's the Iron Dome system. It's a relatively short-range missile system. In fact, when one speaks about what Israel has, people say that it's Israel's Iron Dome in action. In fact, Iron Dome is part of that missile defense system that I've been describing. It's the last line of defense. It can fly to an altitude of 10 kilometers, and it has a range of about 70 kilometers. It can travel to a distance of about 70 kilometers. But it is that last line of defense. It's not optimally suited to take out ballistic missiles. It's better equipped to take on rockets, short-range rockets of the type that Hamas and Hezbollah have been firing. So that's what Israel has been using to defend itself. Obviously, there have been breaches of the system as well, but it appears that not many lives have been lost. One person is thought to have lost their lives, and the damage primarily is believed to be on Israeli military bases. The big question, will there be an Israeli response, and when will that happen? So what's the immediate situation on the ground now? The tension's clearly very high. Marzia Hashemi, a senior journalist from Iran, joins us. Melissa Weiss, the executive editor of Jewish Insider, Ambassador Shashank, the former foreign secretary of India, with us as well. But let me go across to Marzia Hashemi. Marzia, now that Israel has warned of attacks, could you give us a sense of what Iran is doing in preparation?
If we look at the situation, what Iran is doing, Iran sent 400 missiles last night, and 90%, that's what we have reports, 90% hit their target. Iran said that if the Israelis retaliate, then Iran will exert even more force against the Israeli regime. So obviously, Iran was prepared prior to this operation. And I can tell you, I was out all over town today, and inside of the country, things are quite calm. Last night, people were on the streets celebrating. And today, basically, back to business as usual. So actually, I think monitoring what is happening as far as on the people side of things here in Iran, I think that people are quite confident in the ability of being defended, and actually quite relieved that this retaliatory strike finally took place.
Just a couple of days back, we saw some very strong statements from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he said that sooner than later there would be freedom in Iran. Some would suggest that that was almost a statement which could be called regime change. How do people in Tehran actually see that?
Well, it was quite entertaining. I mean, we know that the, if you want to say, Operation Regime Change from the Israeli regime and from its Western supporters have been underway since 1979, since the victory of the revolution. I don't think that any serious Iranians take Netanyahu for his word are serious or would allow a genocide killer to try to determine future of Iranians. So it's another propaganda campaign, and majority of Iranians know better. I'm sure that there are some basically that may believe, but very, very few, and especially inside of the country, we would see more of the Iranians out.
Spencer Critchley,
A child killer.
Right. Spencer Critchley, all of the statements we've been seeing from the United States and from the West seem to indicate that they're firmly on Israel's side at this juncture. There isn't an outright message to end the violence and to work towards a peaceful solution. Is there a sense that this is going to get worse before it gets any better?
Oh, no, I would say there definitely is a very strong message from the United States and its allies to end the violence and seek a peaceful solution. And while the United States is an ally of Israel, and it's certainly one of the firmest alliances that the United States has, the Biden administration has been increasingly critical of the Netanyahu administration for the way it's been conducting its self-defense. I don't speak for the United States, but my understanding of the position of the United States is that Israel, like all countries, has a right to defend itself. And it did suffer a horrendous attack and is constantly under missile barrage from multiple sources. But because Israel is a liberal democracy, like the United States, liberal democracies carry a heavier burden of being careful to avoid harm to civilians. And the United States, in multiple statements, has made clear it's deeply concerned about the civilian suffering and death in Gaza, in the West Bank, and now, as we see in Lebanon. So those two things must be balanced in understanding this.
At the same time, we've seen American destroyers deployed in the Mediterranean engaging these attacks from Iran, number one. We've seen a greater presence of American fighter aircraft deployed in the region. We've heard statements from American leaders warning the Iranian leadership, that there may be action against them. Therefore, the United States is very much part of Israel's military sort of strength or military muscle as part of a coalition, if you like.
Yes.
So therefore, my question remains, what is the path towards peace if you've actually got military deployments on the ground?
Sure. And I think the United States would say those are defensive military deployments. You won't see U.S. forces attacking civilians. Whenever that's happened, either deliberately or through negligence in the history of the United States, it's been seen as a deep violation of our basic principles. Because Israel is an ally and an important strategic ally, you will see the responses you're seeing to defend Israel against, for example, incoming missile barrages. So I think that's consistent with U.S. policy. It's certainly, you know, when I agree with the previous speaker's comments about regime change, when the United States or other countries have tried that sort of thing, you know, wrongly in my view, it's pretty much guaranteed to fail. I think that regime change in Iran will happen from the bottom up from the Iranian people, many of whom deeply resent the repressive regime that they're living under. And it's a sign of repressive regimes that they don't give people the freedom to choose for themselves, and they must use repression and threats of violence in order to maintain their hold on power.
Ambassador Shashank, you know, the differences right now between Iran and Israel are huge. And, you know, it's just a matter of time before Israel attacks. What do you see as a former Foreign Secretary of India as a potential path to prevent an imminent attack?
Well, there are two things. One is that Iran was perhaps quite reluctant to get into the act directly. They were trying to work through their proxies. And I think the Israelis and the Americans, they were all trying to provoke Iran to take a stronger action so that they could bring Iran directly into the open, that they were the ones who were really behind the Hamas and the Hezbollahs and the Houthis. So therefore, they wanted Iran to come out in front. And then to now we have to see whether the Israelis are willing to go all out and have a very strong reaction against the Iranian targets, or would they now just take a slightly softer line in the hope that the Iranian people themselves, as the previous speaker was saying, that from bottom up, the younger people themselves, they would try to bring about a change of attitude among the Iranian leaders, that while it is okay, because Mr. Nasrullah was a respected Shiite leader, so they had to show something, but that does not mean that they should go all out to have their whatever nuclear plans they might have or the ballistic capability that they have developed to be destroyed. And finally, the second part is that the developing countries like India, we feel that we have a very large number of people living in that area. We also have concerns about the import of our energy sources, because we depend up to 80 to 85% on energy imports. And thirdly, we are building up these infrastructural linkages through Iran to Afghanistan and Central Asia in order to, and that has become more important after the Houthi strike on the this Sea of Aden. Therefore, I think we have to be careful. India should be prepared to work along with other countries which would want to bring about peace in the region. We have relations with Iran, with Israel, and with the Palestinians also for a long time. So I think there is a certain amount of trust in the Indian position, but I'm not very sure that right now is the time for people to go ahead with it. India should carry on consultations with other countries, including the direct combatants, and also with other important players in the field.
Marzia, is there a sense of panic? Because we were seeing video from parts of Iran yesterday of people queuing up to fill up fuel in their vehicles. Is there a worry that with an imminent attack coming, that, you know, there is a sense of people bringing in supplies and just waiting for the inevitable? Is that what you're hearing?
Well, I would say that yes. I
mean, Ambassador, just one sec. That question was for Marzia Hashemi. Marzia, go ahead.
I'm not hearing it nor seeing it. I said earlier that I was out all over town today. Last night, it was one of, I can say, jubilation, and people throughout the country were just handing out sweets to each other or fireworks or just wanted to be out together celebrating the retaliatory strikes. And today I was out. Situation was back to normal, just the everyday life, people going work shopping, whatever. Did not get any sense of panic out there about the gas lines that happened last night. Well, there's something with some Iranians, it's something with the psyche. Like anytime anything happens, whether there's, I don't know, it's weather related or there's something going on in the country or whatever, for whatever reason, many of them feel that they definitely have to have a full gas tank. But I just want to respond to one of the previous speakers and talking about inside of this as he called it, the regime in Iran. I'm an American. I'm an American, and I choose to live, an American woman choosing to live inside of Iran. And believe me, I wouldn't allow myself to be repressed. I can tell you as a journalist that I have more freedom here than I did when I worked in the United States, one. And two, the thing about the women and women's rights, for God's sakes, let's be real. I mean, we know that the majority of university students in the country are women. We know that women across the board are very very active in a society. So it's not even about Iran. It's about the continued propaganda, the continued attempts at regime change and to cause problem inside the country. The problem right now is a regime that has killed at least 42,000 people, many say 200,000 people, and the whole Western hegemonic front do not care. Babies are being murdered, cut to pieces, burned, and they have done nothing to stop it. But the talk of the day is trying to change the so-called regime in Iran. Give us a break. I think the world is tired of the propaganda, and I can tell you from the messages that I was getting last night when I was on in front of the camera and monitoring my social media, I was getting messages from all kinds of people all over the world. Right. And we were saying, we are so happy and we thank Iran for doing what we wish we could do.
All right. Marzia, spoken very strongly. Obviously, an Iranian perspective over there. We're bringing in all sides into the story. I'd like to thank our panelists here. I spoke a little while earlier on to Roy Venaza, the ambassador of Israel to New Delhi. Here's what he said. Well, the focus of the world now clearly on Israel after Iran launched a barrage of missiles at Israel last night. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Iran will pay. Most of the missiles were intercepted. According to reports, one of the 180-odd ballistic missiles Iran fired last night landed near the Tel Aviv headquarters of Israeli intelligence Mossad. A video that has emerged on social media shows a massive crater near the Mossad headquarters. Now, Iran has said that the barrage was in response to Israel's aggressive acts, including the killing of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. The war in West Asia now is at a critical juncture. We're joined by a very special guest, Roy Venaza, the Israeli envoy to New Delhi. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us.
Thank you, Mr.
It does seem that despite the intensity of the attacks by Iran last night, they were calibrated in the sense that populated areas of Tel Aviv were not struck, fortunately. Does that imply that Israel's response, when it does come, will also be calibrated?
I wouldn't imply that, Vishnu. And that's the result of the attack. By the way, it wasn't just a barrage of missiles. It's a barrage of 181 yes. ballistic missiles, yes. with each one with a payload between 700 to 1,000 kilograms that is capable of destroying an entire building. Okay, this is unprecedented in the history of warfare. Fortunately, because of the fact that we have the best defense system in the world, we have managed to thwart it. And the only missiles that have actually hit were the ones that hit in open areas. Right. Because usually we do not target those. Okay, so this is a very serious situation. And this is not the first time this is coming from Iran. Now, the Iranians, it's not the Iranian people. We don't have nothing right. against them. It's this regime, this radical regime, has been trying every possible way to destroy the state of Israel. They have stated publicly that they want to destroy the state of Israel. They've been financing for the last 30 years all these terrorist groups with billions and billions of dollars on the account of their own, you know, taking this money from their own people. Mm-hmm. And they are failing. We are determined to defend ourselves. We are not going to allow this regime mm-hmm. to threaten the state of Israel.
Ambassador, what was the damage last night?
Well, I'm just quoting the spokesperson of the IDF. The IDF doesn't give wrong information.
Right.
The right information is that, fortunately, we haven't seen damage out of this barrage because we have defended ourselves against it. Unfortunately, there was a tragic loss of life of a Palestinian from a Gaza origin mm-hmm. that has been hit by a missile in the Jericho area. and he lost his life, unfortunately. He was murdered by this missile. Besides that, we didn't see any major damage caused.
Ambassador, in terms of retaliation against Iran when it does come, because Israel has already said that you will retaliate, does that potentially include strikes on nuclear facilities in Iran, which may be coming up, or oil facilities in Iran? Does it include the entire range of targets?
Well, I'm not going to enter into operational terms because this is not my line of business. We have a challenge here, Vishnu, because this kind of radical people cannot be easily deterred. And we've seen that. Mm. We've seen that when Hamas atrociously attacked us on the 7th of October, they didn't care about their own population. When Nasrallah decided on the 8th of October to attack Israel and has been attacking Israel for the last 11 months, we saw that he doesn't care about the Lebanese people. So we have a challenge here, and we have to give serious blows to these people to understand that their own life is in danger.
And Ambassador, what exactly does that mean? The reason I ask is just, I think, 2 days back, Prime Minister Netanyahu said, and I quote, "Iran will become free a lot sooner than people think." To those of us who are observers of what's happening, that seems to imply regime change. Is that correct,
no,
my assessment?
I think the people are mixing two separate things. Israel will do only what is essential for its security. We are putting our lives on the line. Mm-hmm. The lives of our soldiers are on the line. We are not in the business of imposing political realities in other countries. Mm-hmm. What the Prime Minister said is that he knows very well how empty the Iranian regime shell is. We know from the past that people have revolted against these oppressive regimes. And we hope that this will happen again in Iran, because the people of Iran deserve it.
So you believe that conditions on the ground in Iran are such that there may be I use the word regime change, you may not want to agree with those words, but a change of the leadership sooner than later.
This is not something
which may not be linked to Israel at all.
This is not something that is going to come from outside. This is not something that Israel is going to be engaged with. We are going to be engaged only with the security interests of our people. Mm-hmm. And the Prime Minister was very clear about that. The fact that he is exchanging messages directly with the people of Iran is in order to tell them that Iran is not the enemy of Israel, mm-hmm. that the Persian people and the Persian civilization is an old civilization that had actually amazing contacts with the people of Israel from almost more than 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So we want to restore this kind of connection. And that's why the Prime Minister was talking about the situation in Iran, because he wants to engage with the Iranian people, not with the regime. The regime wants to destroy us. They're not interested in talking to us.
Ambassador, let's take a look at the situation in Lebanon, because in a sense the Prime Minister's message was similar, that your concerns are not with the people of Lebanon at all, it's with Hezbollah. The top leadership of Hezbollah has been eliminated right now. There could be a second tier, a third tier of the leadership. My question is, could this not end up being an indefinitely long battle for you, not one that finds a quick solution?
Well, we have very definite targets that have been actually approved by the cabinet of the State of Israel. What we want to achieve is a situation in which the threat that was posed by Hezbollah, mm-hmm. and the infrastructure that was built in the immediate area of our northern border, that infrastructure will be removed.
So that's the reason why... Are you restricted to northern Lebanon so far? Southern Lebanon, northern Israel at the moment?
We are restricted to achieve the goal that will allow our citizens to go back safely to their homes in northern Israel. We want to achieve a situation in which UN Security Council Resolution 1701 and UN Security Council Resolution 1559 can be implemented on the ground. Israel is not interested in becoming an occupying force in Lebanon. We do not want to determine what is going to be the political future of Lebanon. What we want to achieve is a situation in which the blows against Hezbollah are such that the pressures on them and from within them will bring them to a ceasefire that will respect those resolutions that are in international consensus.
Ambassador, you're talking about the United Nations. Israel in the last little while has been particularly direct with the United Nations Secretary General, saying that he has barred Mr. Guterres from Israeli territory. There was a statement also earlier on saying that, you know, there doesn't seem to have been any condemnation from the United Nations on what Israel has had to see overnight. Where does that leave your equation with the United Nations?
Well, unfortunately, Vishnu, there are several elements within the United Nations. It's not the entire organization, because there are agencies of the United Nations that are doing very important work. But unfortunately, because of the rigged system that you have there, in which there is a majority of countries that actually can manipulate the situation such that they appoint people that are absolutely biased. And when you have a Secretary General that hasn't been condemning this terrible barrage of rockets, but it's not the first time he's not doing it. This is very, very worrisome. It should be concerning not only us, but all countries that are interested in an impartial, neutral UN system. Because when the UN system fails, when you have a UN agency like UNRWA that was built just to perpetuate the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, and when this agency is actually paying the salaries of terrorists, like the one we eliminated 3 days ago in Lebanon, that was in charge of the education of 39,000 people. Can you imagine that? And when we asked the UN to fire him, they only put it on leave.
Sure.
They didn't fire him. So this, you know, countries have to revolt against us. We cannot have a UN system that is rigged. This is too important for us. You cannot have a situation in which a country is working against the UN Charter and menacing the destruction of another member of the United Nations.
Sure.
And the UN Secretary General is not condemning it. So why do we need the United Nations for?
Ambassador, you know, our foreign minister said recently that in a situation like this, the importance of communications can never be understated. Now, we have a great relationship with Israel. We're incredibly popular in this country. But we also have a historic relationship with Tehran. Does Tel Aviv see New Delhi as being potentially a messenger between both sides, because you're both diametrically at opposite ends right now towards working out some sort of solution to peace, which is what everybody wants?
Well, believe me, Vishnu, that we don't have a problem of communication here. We've been communicating indirectly to the Iranians through at least 20 countries that have good relations with Iran. Not to do this, not to do what they did. And they decided to do it. You know, we've been hearing this from European countries for many years. They wanted to have a constructive dialogue with Iran. They wanted to have a friendly dialogue with Iran. And then they wanted to engage with Iran. And yet Iran didn't change its course. And what we are seeing now is that Iranian missiles are threatening the European continent itself. We cannot wait anymore with friendly approaches. We need to put pressure on Iran, on this regime. Because if we don't put pressure on this regime, the entire Middle East is threatened, and we have no other choice but to defend ourselves against these threats.
Is there no diplomatic solution that you see presently?
Well, there can always be a diplomatic solution. When Hezbollah attacked us on the 8th of October in an unprovoked way, we said, let's do a ceasefire. Let's implement UN Security Council Resolution 1701. The United States tried to help us.
Yes.
The French tried to help us. It didn't work. Sometimes, in order to deter aggressors, you have to show strength. Diplomacy can work, always, when it is leaning on foundations that are credible, that the other side will say, okay, I want to engage diplomatically because I have an interest, okay? But these people are different. They don't want to engage in diplomacy.
So, Ambassador, at this juncture, you don't see India having a potential role?
Well, it's up to India to decide. You know, we are not assigning roles to countries. We are benefiting immensely from the friendship of India. We are grateful for the fact that India supported Israel's right to self-defense, that India condemned the atrocious attacks of the 7th of October. We appreciated the telephone call that Prime Minister Modi had with Prime Minister Netanyahu only 2 days ago. And India has an immense role to play on international stage in general, and the Middle East in particular. After this war ends, we will continue building the bridges. We will continue building the Middle East as a corridor of stability that connects Asia and Europe,
sure,
together with our partners.
Yes.
And India is a part of it, is an initiator of it, is a source of it. And therefore, I bless the role of India in this.
Ambassador, you're talking of that economic corridor, right? The one that goes through the Middle East and ends up in Haifa. That has incredible potential, but sadly, it's potential which has been put aside for the moment because of the war. But is that what you're referring to?
Of course, because, you know, people are talking about different geopolitical ideas. You know, many countries,
yes,
have different ideas. The question is, what is the foundation of each idea? And you can assess, as an experienced follower of international politics, you can assess yourself when an idea is connected to reality and when it is disconnected from reality. I think this idea is very much connected to reality. And you know what is the proof? Mm-hmm. Is that during this terrible attack that we have been persisting in sustaining for the last year, not a single Arab country cut relations with us.
Right.
During this year, we actually have been building our security cooperation, our intelligence cooperation. We've been creating a scheme to defend the skies of the Middle East together. What does it tell you? It tells you that after the war is over, all these countries that have joint interests will continue to work together to expand the Abraham Accords, to show to the people of the Middle East that there is an alternative, mm-hmm, to extremism. There is an alternative to fanaticism. There is an alternative to Iran. They shouldn't fear Iran because we are determined. Each and every Israeli citizen is determined to sustain this attack and to prevail. And this is what we are showing.
Sure.
Hamas is no longer a threat on the heart of Israel. Hezbollah has received a very serious blow. And Iran will pay a price for its aggression.
Ambassador, let's talk about the situation in Gaza right now. It is a humanitarian crisis. I don't think anybody would deny that. What is the way out now as the world moves towards reconstruction, assistance, rebuilding, all of that in Gaza? Do you see that happening in a finite period of time?
Yeah, so
there's the hostage crisis as well.
Right. So first of all, we have to bring our hostages back home. What Hamas is trying to do is to extort from us a surrender and a possibility to rearm and regroup and continue subjugating the population of Gaza to their terror regime. We are not going to allow that to happen. We are now concentrating on humanitarian assistance. We have to decide what will happen with how this humanitarian assistance is distributed, because Hamas is constantly using that in order to keep the control of the population. And I'm telling you, no country in the world will come to reconstruct the Gaza Strip as long as these terrorists are controlling Gaza, because they know too well.
Right.
They've already been there. They already did that. They already tried to create a situation in which they can help the population of Gaza without Hamas taking over. It failed. So we have to be determined here. We have to remove the capability of Hamas to control the Gaza Strip, because nobody will do this fight against the terrorists instead of Israel.
All right, Ambassador, thank you very much for joining us, sharing Israel's perspective on this. The world is on edge. I'm sure you would accept that the situation in West Asia, a real crisis. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to take a short break at this stage and continue to track this story very, very closely indeed. Israel says that an attack on Iran is imminent. When will that take place? What are the dimensions of that? We'll have to wait and see. Well, joining us now, Sameer Joshi. He's the CEO of New Space Research. That's a leading Indian drone manufacturer. He's also been a fighter pilot, and he's a military technologist. He follows developments very, very closely, and certainly what's happening in West Asia now. Is it your opinion, Sameer, that Iran has right-sized its attack? This cannot be called a full-fledged ballistic missile or missile assault.
Absolutely, Vishnu. I think those are the right words, you know, right-sized, keeping in mind a lot of geopolitical compulsions as well as its own military response and what, very importantly, what Israel will strike back with. Otherwise, can you explain that, 180 ballistic missiles have struck, the various targets in Israel at least we don't know on any other side beyond the military targets which have struck without causing any major damage. This is definitely what the Iranians would want to keep it as a limited response to show just enough, the will to strike Israel. At the same time, making sure that this doesn't escalate into a full-blown conflict. But of course, we will have to see how Israel responds to this now.
Would you agree that Israel's missile shield was breached?
I think it was definitely saturated. I have been trying to fathom and understand the various videos available on Twitter and other social media sites. As per very clearly laid down videos, a couple of air bases and the Mossad headquarters and maybe some important C4I targets have been struck in a very clinical attack where they have focused on the government agency, which has kind of bothered them most, that is the Mossad, as well as the launch bases for the platforms which have stuck in deep and possibly taken out targets, as well as taken out the bunker where Mr. Nasrallah was the head of Hezbollah, for which this is a retaliatory strike, one of the main reasons. So something that which has been toned down to that an extent. When about 180 to 200 missiles kind of come down within a span of 20 minutes, even the best of the air defense systems in the world are going to be saturated. And I think what was very visible that while the four layers of the system, which is, starting right from the bottom, which is the Iron Dome, going forward to the David Sling, which can intercept targets, could till about 8 to 10 kilometers, going forward towards the layers where the Patriots and the Arrow exothermic ballistic missile, anti-ballistic missile launchers are. This was definitely saturated. The Israelis and the Americans had advanced warning. I think the Iranians had kind of telegraphed the major Western headquarters that they are going to be attacked. There was a very good lookout notice from the US on Twitter. And if we know, I think you would know everybody is prepared for this. Beyond this, what is important to understand is that even the most well-layered kind of defense, you know, if it taken out of context in terms of the numbers it can handle in a finite timeline, will kind of, you know, can be overwhelmed. And what we are seeing is, and what Israel has acknowledged, is about 10% of the missiles have definitely got through. I can say that it may be a bit more. But obviously, the targets are very finite, very military in nature. You know, we are talking of the Nevatem airbase where the F-35s are there, from where they have been. This is in the Negev desert. Then the Tel Air Force Base, where the F-15s are there, and the Mossad headquarters. So what we are also seeing clear impacts from these ballistic missiles. So you are also seeing a lot of debris flying in the air, which is the secondary cause effect of when, you know, anti-ballistic missile or any kind of layered defense has stuck something inbound. So yes, the shield, the air defense shield in Israel was overwhelmed. To what an extent, we'll get more realistic assessments as we go forward. What is very clear, the targets were very military in nature, and there was minimalistic civilian infrastructure damage and civilian casualties.
Yeah. Were hypersonic missiles used, which potentially defeat the system, even if there were interceptor missiles available?
Yeah, so you have to understand what is hypersonic facet, or the what is the hypersonic component of this delivery. I think largely first, let's understand what were the missiles used. What happens? So what Iranians would have aimed for a barrage of missiles and estimated that a number, a certain percentage of them going through the Israeli air defense. So there's always a calculation behind this, you know, how you target certain categories. The first aspect of this is what different kind of ballistic missiles use. So what is the Iranians over the last, you know, attack in back in April would have definitely got a wind of how certain things worked, how the Israeli Iron Dome, the David Sling, as well as, you know, the Arrow systems and the Patriot associated launchers work. And this time, what, in my opinion, there were some images where you saw faster trajectories, inbound trajectories, although, you know, this can be confused by anything which converts from a mid-course to a terminal phase of attack. And these includes the multiple independent reentry vehicles, the MIRVs, which are released by these ballistic missiles, which are also close to about 5 kilometers per second of speed once they come into the final terminal phase. But the hypersonic component of a missile called the Fateh, you know, Fateh-1, this is a derivative of, you know, the I think a missile called the Khyber Shaken.
Yes.
And here it uses a solid fueled rotor, which kind of, you know, propels it in the exhaust sphere to give it better speeds and better maneuverability. This kind of increases the difficulty for the standard ABM layer like the Arrow to kind of intercept them. So I think this is where when hypersonic missiles were used by Iran, this is the claim. But on the terminal phase, I think, there is nothing hypersonic about that. I think we have also seen how Kinzhal is being intercepted by, the so-called hypersonic
missile. So just to break down some of the terms that you are using for the benefit of our viewers, by hypersonic, we are talking about more than Mach 5 or more than five times the speed of sound, right?
Yeah.
Number one. Number two, when you're talking about the terminal phase of the flight, you're talking about the end phase of the flight of a weapon system, a missile in this case, right? And number three, when you talk about saturating the defenses of a system, it means that you're overwhelming a system by a larger number of missiles than what perhaps the sensors or the inbound or the interceptors themselves can take on. Is that right?
Absolutely. I'll just quickly, have a concise snapshot on this. So first, when a missile is launched, it is kind of in a boost phase where the rocket is boosted up. It reaches a certain level of the, of space. And once that booster effect goes, it goes into a coast phase. It has to now start falling towards it because the Earth's gravity is still active. Mm-hmm. Now, this is called the mid-course phase. And here, the missile is traveling at more than the speed of 10 Mach plus, And this mid-course is where you can control the trajectory of the ballistic missile, mid-course as well as the booster phase, how much boost you give. And once, let's say, the medium-range ballistic missiles used by Iran were nearly at the fringe end of their use case when attacking Israel, and that's where, the terminal phase when they entered, the trajectories are not so steep, they're a bit flatter, which was very visible. In the terminal phase is where the weapon payloads being carried either on the multiple independent reentry vehicles, or the MARVs. These are vehicles which can also maneuver.
Yes.
They kind of separate and they start going towards their particular targets. And this is the terminal phase where, again, your speed is close to about Mach 5, initially when you enter. And thereafter, you kind of start to slow down once denser and denser air comes as you start coming to. So exactly what you were saying, Now, when you have a large number of these together coming and at the same time, the air defense has a certain reaction time. And this reaction time dictated by the number of interceptors available in that layer kind of will dictate the saturation point, right? So if, let's say, your ability is to handle 100 missiles in, a minute, that means you need to have at least 200 of these interceptors ready, because there is a certain kill probability per launcher, per vector. So there is always, if you had the Liberty, you would have fired 1, 2, 3, 4 of these to get 100% kill probability. So this is what dictates the saturation. And that is where I think the Iranians have calculated per their own over-target requirements, what is the least number of warheads which they need to strike at those air bases or the sites which they are aiming for. And this is where we'll get more information in the days ahead. Yeah.
Sameer, is it possible that Israel didn't have the number of Arrow interceptors? In other words, their most advanced, most long-range interceptors available to them, because physically manufacturing these missiles, that system has already been used extensively in the last few months. It takes its toll on the numbers of missiles available, and therefore perhaps interceptions were made of only the most pressing targets, and that there were some targets which were perhaps deemed to be away from an area which needed to be protected, which were let go of. Is that possible?
Absolutely. Vishnu, Israel has the most advanced ballistic missile defense system, a layered kind of defense. I say it because they are the guys who have faced, especially in the last 1 year, the maximum number of missiles in a most very dense kind of environment as we go forward. So the Arrow is a very specialist missile. The cost of a single Arrow anti-ballistic missile is maybe more than a ballistic missile itself. Mm-hmm. A single ballistic missile will cost anything. A good one will cost anything between about $5 million to anything between, take it to a $20 million band. And obviously, there is a limit to how many they can house. They are also used for very high priority targets. So these were MRBMs. They were intercontinental ballistic missiles. There are other threats that Israel also faces. So they kind of are reserved for some very specialist targets. Had they been used in adequate number today, I would not have the information. But what would very much appear that if only 10% of so-called ballistic missiles have got through, Israel would have wanted to use a maximum arrows with them. Did they have the right number available to them? That is, again, something of speculation today.
Sure.
But the analysis is very clear that the majority of the ballistic missiles were stopped high up, and rest were handed over to, you know, the secondary layers as the debris or the warhead came closer to the ground.
Would it also be fair to assume that Iran would be facing constraints as far as the number of ballistic missiles available to them henceforth? Because there have been several rounds now of missiles which have been fired over the last several months against Israel. And again, a ballistic missile is not something you churn out. There is a certain cost involved, there is technology to be acquired, et cetera, and fabrication under intense international scrutiny through satellite surveillance and other means. So therefore, this is not something that can indefinitely continue, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You bang on, Vishnu, when you say that, because Israel can only use a certain number of these retaliatory components which it has. And ballistic missiles are very hard to come by to kind of have them in your arsenal to kind of have an unending kind of supply also doesn't make sense financially. So they have very much fired. You can well imagine the need for this salvo simply because, this was a retaliatory measure which they had to do, mm-hmm. Not only because, the Hezbollah chief was knocked off by Israel, but also to the fact that, I personally believe if Prime Minister Netanyahu himself is calling for a regime change back in, Iran. So there is a degree of urgency in this attack, and which is far more. But as we discussed before, there is also a degree of guarded measure where they don't want an escalation beyond that simply because they cannot afford it. They will have a lot of issues.
And they don't have a ballistic missile defense shield themselves in anywhere close to the level of technology which the Israelis have, right? So when Iran comes under attack, they would be hit much harder.
Absolutely. The best system which they have is the S-300, which has very severely curtailed ballistic missile interception capabilities, which is more suited. The system is more suited towards cruise missile defense and otherwise. One question you asked previously, and I missed out on that, was, when you have limited number of interceptors as part of a defense shield, obviously you have algorithms inbuilt which will reject certain trajectories of ballistic missiles which are headed possibly towards nowhere. Mm-hmm. That's how you kind of save on rounds. So it has possibly happened. We have noted a lot of impacts. Some may have actually hit in areas where the Israelis would have allowed them to hit. But, there is also a fact that, and especially when you look at the video footage of the Nevatim, a lot of missiles have seemingly hit around the runway and, the majority of a dispersed kind of targets within the airbase.
And a final question, there isn't anything to assume that an overwhelming number of Israeli stealth fighters, the F-35, would have been hit because they had advanced warning. And the standard practice is that you scramble your fighters, you move them away when an attack is imminent. So, and of course, the Israelis won't say what the cost on the ground was. But it's fair to assume that they may not have lost very much in terms of those very expensive and precious stealth fighters.
Absolutely. Again, Vishnu, I think if you have advanced warning, and even if you don't have advanced warning and you are, carrying out the large scale strikes that you have, you always have your best assets always available to shoot and scoot in a very timely manner. So I think as soon as they would have had the advanced warning, they would have put in place measures where most of these important assets would have either been flown away or would have been in the air to kind of assist in shooting down of, secondary, which they would have noticed. Remember, when this advanced warning would have come, they wouldn't have known it was only going to be ballistic missiles. They would have also assumed, a large number of these cruise missiles and, the Shahid class of newer generation long-range UAVs, UAVs, the kamikaze UAVs would have been in the air. So, yes, the Israelis know how to manage, and they are past masters at protecting their assets.
All right. I'd like to thank you very much, Sami Joshi, for being with us, for sort of breaking down the technology and what exactly took place in a devastating missile attack. What's going to take place in West Asia? No clear answers at this stage. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.